Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we'll be exploring the cosmic evolutionary impulse. My guest is Jude Kurivan, who has a master's degree in physics from Oxford University and also has a doctoral degree in archaeology. She is the author of many books, including The Wave, a life-changing journey into the heart and mind of the cosmos. The eighth chakra, what it is and how it can transform your life. The 13th step, a global journey in search of our cosmic destiny, and written with Irvin Laszlo, Cosmos, a co-creator's guide to the whole world. More recently, she has written and been interviewed on this channel on the cosmic hologram, Information at the Center of Creation, and her most recent book, The Story of Gaia, The Big Breath, and the Evolutionary Journey of Our Conscious Planet. Jude is in the UK, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Jude. It's a real pleasure to be with you once again.
And me with you, Jeff. It's been nearly 6 years, actually, I think.
Yes, last time I had the pleasure of interviewing you. You came to see me in Las Vegas, and I've been living in Albuquerque for the last 5 years. So
exactly.
Yeah, time has passed, but I have to say, in reading your newest book, The Story of Gaia, I am just overwhelmed by the enormity of the scope of the book, the vision that you brought to it, and not only the largeness of the vision, but the vastness of all the details that you assembled to support this vision, that basically, to sum it up in a nutshell, that the whole universe is conscious.
Yes, essentially. And of course, this was the ancient understanding. You know, what I'm really delighted about is how this leading edge science, of course, it is evidence-based, as I'm sure we'll dive into. It's evidence-based, as was my previous book that we shared our interviews with. And this is what I think is so important, because it's evidence at all scales of existence and many fields of research, as you know. And it is converging with universal wisdom teachings in the most wonderful, and I feel empowering, way. It's almost inviting us, isn't it, to be co-evolutionary partners with our entire universe and our planetary home, Gaia.
And you start with what we used to call the Big Bang, but I like the way you've renamed it, the Big Breath. It reminds me, and I think you allude to this, of the Vedic cosmology and the idea that Vishnu breathes a breath, and it may last billions of years.
Absolutely. And you know, I felt able to sort of relanguage that, because again, we know that our universe didn't begin in the implied chaos of a Big Bang. We know it wasn't big, it was minute, but when we use the term bang, it implies that sort of chaotic beginning. And it was absolutely not that. It was, our universe began in the most incredibly ordered state and extremely fine-tuned. So what's happened from that first moment that I have relanguaged as an ongoing Big Breath is our universe has embodied this incredible evolutionary impulse from simplicity to complexity. And of course, like you were saying, the Vedic tradition talks about our universe in exactly those terms. So it was a rather, for me, it was a lovely, you know, again, convergence of the sort of the leading edge science and that ancient and deep understanding.
One of the factoids in your book that struck me, and there are probably thousands of them, is the idea that at the very beginning, the The whole universe was, I know it's referred to as a singularity, but you point out it's approximately the quantum space, the Planck size of, you know, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters and incredibly hot, trillions and trillions of times hotter at that tiny little space than the hottest stars are today.
Absolutely. But, you know, when we think of heat, we think of sort of chaos in a way of sort of, you know, atoms moving around at crazy speeds and all the rest of it. You know, just from research on our sun, the surface of the sun is about 6,000 degrees centigrade. But when we go out into what's called the chronosphere, that rises to millions of degrees. And yet the magnetic fields that hold that sort of that system, mean that it is again incredibly ordered. And what we find with our universe is exactly what you're saying. It began in the hottest state possible, the Planck temperature, which is all those trillions on trillions on trillions of times of degrees. Yet there's a wonderful law of physics that says in a contained system like our entire universe, the temperature is what's called inversely proportional to what I call its information content. So at that very beginning, the informational content of our universe was at its lowest level. It was as simple as it could be, but no simpler. And the temperature was at its highest. And ever since, as space has expanded and time's flowed forward, the temperature's dropped as the informational content has risen. Isn't that? I just think that's so cool. I don't mean that as a facetious call, but it's so wonderful because what I've been able to do that we spoke about before, but I've taken on even further with the story of Gaia, is to understand how our universe is co-created.
You refer to the I Ching that says, in the beginning there was one, and the one became two, and the two became three, and then the three became the 10,000 things.
Yeah. And isn't that a beautiful description about that original, really simple state in which the universe, our universe, came into being? But of course, it had everything there in potential. It had the laws of physics, which are these dynamic, relational, again, as simple as it can be, but no simpler. It's very set up. Was how, as I wrote in the Cosmic Hologram, yeah, how to make a perfect universe. So that one indeed became differentiated. I think what your point is, though, which is key, and what the I Ching's point is, which is key, is that wholeness remains. It just becomes differentiated into two and three and then 10,000 things. And our old, you know, hitherto paradigm has been one of materialism and separation. And now that's all the evidence is turning that completely on its head and far closer to what the I Ching describes and the Vedic traditions describe.
One of the wonderful things about your book, The Story of Gaia, is that you go step by step through 13.8 billion years of cosmic evolution. And even from the very first fractions of a second, the way things evolved had to be that way in order for us to be here today having this conversation.
Exactly. And you know, that for me was one of the most profound. I mean, I sort of knew this from all the work I'd done previously, but actually really delving into that story at the depth of the book, I was in awe. I was in reverent wonder and awe at exactly how that happened, where you get time and again, the universe prepares for potential, you know, future complexity, and that complexity that when it manifests, it might be, you know, 100 million years hence. And that is so extraordinary that this evolutionary impulse is so adamant. And I talk about, as you know, I talk about the universe embodying. It doesn't just exist and evolve. I think the evidence is showing us it exists to evolve.
Well, you talk about numbers, and I think the number three, for example, is particularly important. We see the number three in quarks, in the very most fundamental particles that we understand today in physics. You also talk about the Fibonacci ratio and the golden mean and how what we think of today as sacred geometry was embodied in the very earliest formation of matter.
Absolutely. And I also, as you'll recall, I mentioned the quadrivium, this curriculum of wisdom teachings that are based on number. And where number in space is geometry, where number in time is music, and where the whole of our universe is essentially, the cosmology of our universe is founded on those principles. And of course, we find, and again, I say story after story of this, the incredible harmonics and resonances that prevail at many, many different scales throughout our entire universe, and the foundational relational geometries that underpin the appearance of it.
Now, another really beautiful aspect of this book, and I know how hard you worked on it. I know, for example, that during the year 2021, when you were in the middle of your book, up came the Bigelow competition, and you thought about entering that competition. You would have been a very strong contender, I know. But you gave it up in order to work on this book. It was so important to you. And every chapter, as I recall, begins with a meditation. The book, writing of this book was a meditative process for you.
It was. And you're very gracious to mention the Bigelow. And I want to sort of congratulate you again for your success with the Bigelow Prize. Totally deserved. So I'm just delighted. It went to the right person at the right time to be doing the wonderful work that you do. But yes, I just felt I could not. The book was so important for me. And I actually feel that the book wrote me in that sense. And I know that the very early readers, I don't know, I'd love to, I mean, I'm so grateful for your such a positive response to it. And I've had people who have, you know, offered wonderful endorsements, as you know, saying that, you know, the book really did change them. It really sort of opened up in them a sense of the living universe within them, you know, Gaia within them. And that's such a joy to hear of people having those experiences of reading the book.
In fact, I know there's a long list of endorsements from, I would say, the most prominent names in the field of consciousness exploration these days. But back to your meditative process, it strikes me as wonderful that you would wake up one morning and think to yourself, now I want to experience what it was like for the universe to begin to form protons and neutrons and particles out of this oneness.
It was a sheer joy. And of course, you know, with, you know, my own journey of walking between worlds since I was very young. So it just, but what it did was it just brought me into a really deeper and deeper and deeper relationship. You know, I mentioned a little bit ago about experiencing embodying. And I feel that the book writing me has helped me to embody that understanding and that realization to a much deeper level. And of course, these are really, you know, they're my experiences, but there's an invitation for everyone to enter this relationship with Gaia and the whole world.
Gaia, the ancient Greek mother goddess, is you're using the name Gaia to refer to our planet, the Earth. And you point out we can't even talk about our planet without talking about the entire cosmos. But as I understand it, our planet is maybe 4.5 billion years old. The cosmos, as we understand it, 13.8 billion years old. So roughly 2/3 of this evolutionary history took place before our planet was even birthed.
Absolutely. But when you look at that, whatever, 9 billion plus years, everything was in that evolutionary progress and, you know, progress and purpose to get to planetary systems, not just ours, but we now know, looking outside our solar system, that there looks to be more planets in our galaxy than stars. And if you add that, you know, take that to the entire universe, think of that abundance of potential. And the other thing is that when we start, of course, our universe began as simple as possible, but no simpler. So we're moving from hydrogen and helium hundreds of millions of years into generations of stars. But the wonder is that when those stars, and the really early stars, were massive stars, and rather like rock stars, they lived hard and they died young. But when they did, instead of going through their nuclear fuel and just becoming embers, some of them were so massive that they actually collapsed into huge black holes that then coalesced into supermassive black holes to form the centers of galaxies. The others exploded. And when they exploded, all their elemental abundance was gifted to the interstellar medium. And over three generations of stars, interstellar clouds of gas and dust formed, which had not just ice by then, bathed in ultraviolet light from nearby stars by then, but now we know all the prebiotic harbingers, the forerunners of biological life, so that when then the next stage of forming a planetary system happened, it was like at the birthing, all of these further potential for us came into our solar system. So Venus, Mars, and Earth were all water planets to begin with, almost certainly. But Gaia is the planet that was in the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold. So this wonderful water planet that is our planetary home was gifted by these vast amounts of water and these incredibly preparatory prebiotic molecules to then birth her biological children from very early on and continue that process of simplicity to complexity.
And one of the other wonderful things, I say wonderful, some people might not think so. You could call it punctuated equilibrium, but another way to look at it is there were various collisions, and one might think of them as disasters. For example, the creation of our moon, or the way in which apparently the early formation of the planet Jupiter as it moved across the solar system from a near solar orbit to where it currently is, much further away from the sun. All of these things were in effect necessary for yes. us to be able to flourish to the extent that we do today.
Totally. I love that you mentioned Jupiter. It's called the Grand Tack hypothesis. And what it's showing is our stable and resonantly stable planetary system as it is now was not how it was partway through its life cycle. Our planetary system began in a sort of series of resonant orbits around our star, Sol. But when the planets had formed, they weren't in the place, or certainly the outer planets weren't in the places they are now. And that was really important because that little, Jupiter coming into the sort of inner solar system, you might consider as a wrecking ball, actually cleared all the debris to enable Gaia and the inner planets to continue their orbits. And, you know, you're mentioning this formation of our moon, Luna. The best hypothesis we have at the moment, the best evidence, we have this evidence geologically and in many other ways, is that a body about the size of Mars actually came in from the outer solar system and crashed into the early Gaia. She wasn't really Gaia then. She was just this protoplanet. But that merger, as it were, threw out enough material to form our moon. And in fact, the remnants of that body, which we call Theia, who in Greek mythology is the mother of Selene, the moon goddess, we're actually geologically able. There are two major rock formations near the core of Gaia, and they're quite different, and we think they're the remnants of Theia, but they stabilize Gaia. And our moon, Luna, is such a large size compared to Gaia. It's more like a twin system. She's held us stable. Her tides, when that first happened, and she was much nearer to us than she is now, helped Gaia keep warm in the early days of our solar system, where our sun was a third less bright. If Luna hadn't been there, we would have frozen. All the water on Gaia would have frozen to the extent we might never have been able to get through that part of our early history and go on as she has gone on since. So exactly what you're saying, at every point. And then there was this whole arc, wave on wave of complexity, and then biological organisms getting to the end of their arc and Gaia going, okay, that's it, we're on to the next. So it's been so purposeful, Jeff, hasn't it? And so wondrous to see how that has progressed until now.
Well, I certainly want to talk about biological evolution, but before we get there, you bring up another amazing, to me, fact. And I know you've refrained in your book from using the word amazing and wonderful over and over and over again, but all of these facts that you bring together are just that. In this instance, I'm thinking of the fact that the moon is 400th the size of the sun, and the sun is 400 times further from us than the moon, which allows for the possibility, in addition to the orbits being along the same plane, for the possibility of total solar eclipses that we experience.
Okay, I was sort of researching how long has that relationship, 400 times difference in size, 400 times exact difference in distances, been the case. And it's certainly been for many millions of years, but it wasn't always thus. You know, when the original sort of Theia, Gaia, Luna birthing happened, as I mentioned, Luna was much, much closer. And that was perfect for that moment. But the sort of planetary dynamics has meant that over that period of time, you know, 4.5 billion years, that Luna's moved further away, and her magnetic field has reduced dramatically. But we're now in this stability because she's now moving only centimeters a year. So we're now in this wonderful relationship of stability that will probably last for the rest of the time of our solar system, until Sol goes, you know, red giant in many billions of, likely billions of years to come. But it is remarkable as to how that has happened. And, you know, she's also got one face to us, which again adds to that stability. The tides, of course, are vital, because the very early tides were massive, but they help to get things moving. The tides now are wonderful distributors of nutrients around Gaia's waters. And of course, her tides also affect the liquid rocks of her magma, of Gaia's magma beneath the surface. So Luna is vital to life, all life, including biological life on Gaia.
And I gather biological life began roughly a billion years ago on this planet, maybe earlier.
It did. It was much earlier than that. We know that the very, very, very simplest of what we might call early biological life began very soon, actually, probably something like 3.8 billion years ago. But it's a very, very, very sensitive, complex process to move from those very, very early harbingers of life. But all the building blocks were there. And in such a way, this informational genius, this informational intelligence, where they could come together, you know, for example, DNA and RNA. There's a story I tell in the book about a particular enzyme. Now, enzymes are like biological catalysts. They speed up reactions. And in the very, almost very, very early on, there was an enzyme that was evolved called ODCase. That's short for a much longer word. But ODCase enabled a reaction that would have taken millions of years to happen in milliseconds. And that reaction, milliseconds, enabled the forerunner of RNA, which of course, along with DNA, is crucial to biological organisms, to again evolve. Without that enzyme speeding up that reaction by millions upon millions of times, no biological evolution could subsequently occur. I mean, the whole story of biology is just so phenomenal of itself. We could be hours just going into that.
Biology is such a complex subject, and it's almost overwhelming to talk about the early origins of life on this planet and its division into plants and animals and fungi and so on. One of the interesting facts I gathered from your book is that some people say fungi, some people say fungi. How do you pronounce it?
I'm middle of the road. I'm fungi.
Well, one of the points you make about fungi is that they're more like animals than plants.
I know. The evolution of biologists have been having a wild time over the last sort of 10 years or so, because so much of what they thought they knew, they've had to sort of throw up in the air and come out again. And I actually think they're on the sort of the base camp of Everest on where they're moving to, because of course the Darwinian, and it was not Darwin, it was the subsequent folks to Darwin who really got caught into this idea of random mutations driving evolution. And the evidence is that that's just not the case. So we can go into that if you'd like. But yes, I mean, fungi and is alongside, is more an animal than a plant. And of course, when the evolution of biological organisms went from the oceans, went from the waters to the land, fungi and plants were co-evolutionary partners and still are in that whole process. And there's some wonderful stories to talk about fungi and plants.
Yeah, I know lately it's come out that there are fungi that sort of surround the roots of trees and mm-hmm. help the plants communicate with each other, and that these fungi or fungi networks are vast. They can cover hundreds and hundreds of miles.
Well, the largest biological organism we know of is a honey fungus in a secret location in the USA. And it's both the largest and probably the oldest continuing community of a biological organism. And yes, you're referring to what we call mycelium networks that connect. I mean, the very earliest trees back in the sort of early Carboniferous period, the ones that formed the coal seams, the huge coal seams, actually evolved before fungi evolved to be their co-evolutionary partners as the mycelium networks that coat the roots and actually cooperate in nutrient transfer with the soil. But these early trees didn't have a mycelium network. Also, the other interesting thing is, at that time, a fungus called white wood rot fungus hadn't evolved. So when these trees grew, they grew very tall, and they grew almost as lonely sentinels rather than a community of a forest. But when they came to the end of their life, they fell over. Their roots were quite shallow. They fell over, but there was nothing to rot them. There was nothing to recycle them. So they just fell on top of each other. And the weight eventually became peat, and the peat eventually became coal. So we have these huge coal seams that were from those early trees. But the point was, because they breathed out oxygen and breathed in carbon dioxide, which of course is photosynthesis, they oxygenated Gaia's atmosphere and therefore again gave more energy into the process of biological evolution. So in my view, those trees and the coal seams, which sequestered all that carbon, were never meant to be dug up. They were Gaia's way of rebalancing the atmosphere to more oxygen and therefore enabling greater complexity of biological organisms to evolve.
My understanding is that the earliest organisms were, I think the term is anaerobic. They didn't breathe oxygen because there was no oxygen at the time in the atmosphere. But oxygen was actually, I think one might say, a poison to those organisms. But they had to, at one point, they had to mutate and become aerobic organisms.
Or they decided to go deeper underground. Or continue to be in anaerobic situations like bacteria have been. But you're absolutely right. And again, it's all part of this incredible process, because had the original atmosphere of Gaia been heavily oxygenated, with the heat that was there, it would probably burnt up, because oxygen, of course, is very fiery. So with a very heavy methane and carbon dioxide, first of all, it also helped keep Gaia warm in those early days, and also enabled biological organisms that were indeed anaerobic to work with methane as a sort of source, a metabolic source. But then eventually this thing called the great oxygenation event went on, because oxygen is much more energy efficient. And therefore, if you want to move from simplicity to complexity, oxygen is great as long as it doesn't poison you. So Gaia had to find a way of her biological children being able to breathe oxygen without it killing them, and actually using that oxygen, which we do in the mitochondria of each of our cells, as little engines, but protecting the rest of the cell from what that oxygen could do if it got loose. So, you know, complex biological organisms spend a lot of effort on making sure that that doesn't happen.
I know in cosmology there is something known as the anthropic principle. Some people say that one way to think of it is to say that human beings today used retrocognitive psychokinesis in order to prepare the universe for our coming, so to speak. But it wasn't just the early stages of the universe. It was step by step. All of these events along the way were really necessary for what we think of as human civilization.
Absolutely. And, you know, going back to the point I made earlier about, you know, we now think that there's more planets in our galaxy than stars. You know, the universe, it's like life will find a way. And I mean, life in the widest sense of the living universe. But when we get to planetary systems and planets, and especially rocky planets that are able to be water planets, and including some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, where we now think that there's oceans beneath the ice. That water is vital for biological organisms. So to have planetary systems and rocky planets where that possibility is occurring enables that further complexity. And of course, we're not talking about human consciousness per se, although we are, because we are microcosmic co-creators of that evolutionary impulse of our universe. But that's true of any individuated self-awareness that the universe's evolutionary impulse has been able to nurture and guide informationally and intelligently through all of this, these billions of years.
When I was an undergraduate student studying biology, one of the surprising facts to me that I learned is that in zoology, we have the phylums, and we, humans, are part of the phylum known as vertebrates. But vertebrates weren't the first on this planet. There were, for example, sharks I don't believe sharks are vertebrates. I could be wrong about that. Maybe they're close, but they don't have a bony skeleton the way we do.
That's right. They don't have a bony skeleton, but you're absolutely right. Before vertebrates were invertebrates.
And they sort of paved the way. They had to evolve to a point where we had fish with bony skeletons who could then begin to migrate onto the land.
Absolutely. And of course, sharks predated that in a way, but they are so incredibly efficient that they're still with us after tens of millions of years. And if you go back, as you say, where life, biological life began was in the waters of Gaia. And so the waters act as a sort of flotation device. And so in a way, being invertebrate, those very, very simple single-celled and then multi-celled creatures were quite soft. And there's a period called the Ediacaran, which I love. And it predates what we often call the Cambrian explosion, which happened about 500 or so million years ago. But the Ediacarans were the first animals. And they were developing this whole sort of symmetry, this bodily symmetry, and this differentiation into a body part that took in nutrients and a body part that got rid of nutrients. And so built up from that situation. And most of them were very, very small. But the interesting thing about the Ediacaran era is that it wasn't really a competitive era. Every animal, and some looked like plants, but they were animals, sort of had its own niche, but there wasn't what we might later call a food chain. But the thing with the dying out, there was an environmental change, massive. The Ediacaran creatures died out, and then this whole new revolutionary new creatures came along that became more complex. And so developed eyes and spines, and that was when the whole biomineralization really took off. And then there was this sort of like this body race between beings that ate other beings and beings that were eaten by the beings. but it was necessary because that drove that additional complexity. Mm-hmm. And Gaia and the universe's whole impulse is from simplicity to complexity. So collaborative relationships, sometimes competitive relationships, but when we move to greater complexity, cooperative relationships abound.
People today talk about the sixth extinction, which is an anthropic extinction, meaning caused by humans. And we hear about this. Many species are dying on a daily basis, whole species. But since it's referred to as the sixth extinction, there were five previous major extinctions of life on this planet caused, for example, by volcanic activity or meteors. And all of that seemed to be necessary, or we wouldn't be here at all either.
Totally. And another factor, which often isn't identified as such in those major, major extinctions, nonetheless, is an ebb and flow of what's called the carbon cycle throughout Gaia's, what I call Gaiasphere, because, this entire sentience of her rocks and minerals, waters, atmosphere, and biosphere as a Gaiasphere. But that has pulsed complexity through. But you're absolutely right. Without those changes, we would not be here. 66 million years ago, you referred to the asteroid, the impact in what's now the Yucatan Peninsula, or just off the coast of the Yucatan. That was extraordinary in itself because it struck at just the right moment to cause the maximum damage. It struck with some bedrock of gypsum. So although it was in shallow water, so the tsunamis were absolutely huge, but also it raised into the atmosphere such toxic levels of bedrock and gypsum-based bedrock that the demise of the dinosaurs was incredibly rapid. The only dinosaurs that were able to escape are what we call birds. Birds are dinosaurs, the only ones that continued. But our ancestors were tiny little, probably shrew-like beings that were likely nocturnal, that scuttled around in the undergrowth, trying to avoid dinosaurs, probably, and other predators. But that gave them the opening. And very rapidly, again, thanks to something called horizontal gene transfer and a whole raft of genetic rapid transfers, not the old random mutations fallacy, but very, very detailed, specific, meaningful, and guided informational assemblage enabled, again, this next pulse of biological evolution to really take off. And here we are.
It makes me wonder, Jude, about the human race. Are we also part of an evolutionary process so that we build this civilization? We may very well destroy ourselves or be destroyed, and that will be preparation maybe in millions of years in the future for some other evolutionary wave that will supersede us.
It may well do. I mean, just to say that point, I mean, in the book towards the end, I go back to our hominin origins about 6.5 million years ago. You know, we're almost up to today in 13.8 billion year journey. But 6.5 million years ago, a hominin called Ardipithecus ramada came into evolutionary being. And Ardi, and I've had the great joy of being in Ethiopia not long after Ardi was discovered there. But Ardi was very interesting because, unlike the other, apes and chimpanzees and our forebears in that sense that sort of separated from our lineage 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 million years ago, Ardi, the male and the female of Ardi were around the same size and they had the same dentition. Now, you may think, well, what's teeth got to do with this? But it has a great deal to do with this, because if you look at gorillas or chimpanzees, the males are much bigger, the teeth are much longer, much bigger, and therefore they have a very sort of harem type community. You know, so there's an alpha male and then females. With Ardi, our direct ancestor, it was not like that. I say that Ardi was born to love as a bond pair. And our story over the last 6.5 million years, through not just us, but we have many relatives from Neanderthals and many other types of ancient hominins that are cousins, were all of that ability. They all were socialized beings where that bond pair and that family, gathering was part of their heritage and their evolutionary potential. So in that sense, we are here because of that evolutionary development of empathy, of a deeper empathy, because we go back and there are still maternal caring and all the rest of it. But in that moment, Gaia took on a whole new chapter of potential for empathy, for cooperation, for self-awareness, to realize the me and the we, and now potentially the all. So that's been, I think, the journey ever since, and that's where we're at, and that's our choice. Do we step into that potential and destiny that's there for us?
Well, it seems as if as civilization evolved, that humans have always had an intuition about our place in the universe. I'm thinking of, for example, the golden mean.
Yes.
You see it in Greek temples and ancient architecture, but as you point out, that relationship existed in the earliest period of the universe. The ratio between protons and neutrons, even before atoms and molecules evolved.
But those intuitions, I think, are wonderful, because what they're showing us as self-aware beings is that we do have the ability to intuit, to engage with the living universe at that deeper, non-local, you know, profound level of awareness. You know, we go back to the Vedic sages of ancient India. We go back to the I Ching. We go back to indigenous wisdom. You know, understanding geometry. I mean, we now know the Greek geometers just had a straight edge and something to write with, and understood that, you know, geometry is the basic relationships of our universe. We now know that at the Planck scale, that universal information is actually pixelated in triangular areas. We now know that, you know, we spoke a little bit about it. Yeah, all of the fractal patterns that we find from embodied in atoms all the way up to the entire universe. We see these patterns that are innately relational and geometrical. And the ancient Greeks understood that at a both not just at intuitive level, but they actually played with the patterns and realized, you know, the musical and the geometries that they embody.
Jude, since I read your book, I had an insight, and in a way, for me, it's a troubling insight. And I wonder if you might share your reflections, because I think you realize we live in a time that is more politically polarized than at any other time in my lifetime, certainly. And it seems to be a global phenomenon. It's not just in my country or your country. As I was reading your book and realizing that these various, what one might call catastrophes that took place in historical periods led to new birthings and new awakenings on the planet. Could it be that this political polarization that I personally detest, I don't like it, but could it be that it's really happening for a deeper reason than anything that gets discussed in political conversations, for example?
I agree with you. I think it is. I think what's happening is the evolution of the impulse of the entire universe and Gaia is flowing through our collective psyche at the moment. And our collective psyche has essentially been operating from a perspective of fragmentation. It's been operating from this paradigm of materialism and separation. And a worldview of separation drives essentially a world of suffering with inequalities and injustices and all that we've got. And yet what happens in evolutionary processes is that underlying the appearance, for example, of an ecosystem, there are what's called attractors, and these are informational basins that then appear as ecosystems or weather patterns or whatever they may be. So underpinning our collective, underpinning actually is our collective psyche, is this attractor basin of awareness, and it's playing out in all the ways it's playing out. But in evolution, what happens when such an attractor becomes unsustainable because it's reached the extremes of what it can hold? A higher attractor begins to form. And in that higher attractor, it's a greater level of coherence. And so what I feel is happening is that our collective consciousness is in that process of breaking down from the old fragmentation and actually breaking through potentially to a higher level of coherence, cooperation, and conscious evolution. Now, we may not make it, because if there isn't sufficient crystallization, as it were, in that higher potentizing and potential, then the system cannot transform. But if there is, we can. And that's why I suspect you and I are having this conversation today, because that is that potential, that conscious evolution of us as a species is what we both serve. And it seems to me that we absolutely are in an existential crisis. But in the past, such a crisis has almost driven that evolutionary impulse.
One thing you have to say is that the universe can be very patient. It's taken us 13.8 billion years to get to this point. And I know you write about times in the history of the Earth when the biological evolution was sort of at a standstill because of volcanic activity, for example, that the standstill might have lasted for millions of years before things move forward again.
You know, there's three levels, if you like, of the pulse of biological and Gaiosphere evolution. One is when conditions are pretty stable. And then not a lot happens, you know. Organisms are organisms, the Gaiosphere is the Gaiosphere. And then there are cycles called Milankovitch cycles, which are about the ellipticity of Gaia's orbit, about the wobble on her axis and the tilt of the axis and other factors. But those cycles drive further evolution. And then you have these catastrophic breakdowns and breakthroughs. And for the last 12,000 years, conditions on Gaia, the environment of Gaia, has been quite stable. There's been very little actual biological emergence and change. That is now in profound change. As you say, you know, due to our anthropic, our human behaviors, we are in a sixth, at least, you know, catastrophic extinction process. And yet, we are also at this potential opportunity to evolve. And this is our moment of choice. Do we stay in that dis-ease and the illusion of separation? Or do we wake up to remember we're inseparable, a microcosmic co-creators of a universe that, and a planet that exists to evolve?
Jude Kerevin, this has been a most amazing conversation. I'm so delighted to reconnect with you again. I'm so grateful to have read your book. I think it's absolutely a masterpiece. I recommend it highly to our viewers, and I hope we can have many more conversations. I'd like to invite you back to New Thinking Aloud over and over again, because there's so much wisdom and depth and science and precision coming from what you have been exploring. I am so grateful to be able to share you with our audience. Thank you, Jude, so much for being with me today.
Jeff, thank you. And, you know, whenever you'd like to invite me back, it's a yes. So thank you very, very much.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us.